As I call your name, please state how you vote. Director Ford.
Yes.
Director Plambeck.
Yes.
Director Bronstein.
Yes.
Director Armitage.
Yes.
Director Cawley.
Yes.
Director Kelly.
Yes.
Director Peterson.
Yes.
Director Gutzeit.
Yes.
Vice President Ozohowski.
Yes.
President Martin.
Yes.
Thank you. The consent calendar is approved, and that includes resolution numbers SCV-315, SCV-316, SCV-317, and SCV-318.
Thank you, Board. We now can move on to item six, action items for approval. We do have two action items on the agenda for tonight. I would ask the general manager if he'd like to make any opening remarks before we go on to item 6.1.
I think this is as a result of an item that arose while we were considering the broader policy on our employee benefits, and staff have developed an alternative to consider tonight. I think that's the one, unless I've got it wrong.
Thank you, Mr. Stone.
Good. You move fast.
We can move on to item 6.1.
Rochelle is going to present this. Sorry. Yeah.
This item is presented by the Chief Financial and Administrative Officer, Rochelle Patterson. This is to approve the revised employee manual policy number 18, other benefits. Ms. Patterson.
Yes, good evening. So a few months ago during the Finance and Administration Committee meeting, there was a discussion on employer contributions for employees' medical coverage ahead of the open enrollment period. A couple of public comments were emailed from retirees raising concerns over a retiree's fixed income and the increased retiree contribution for out-of-state medical coverage. The out-of-state retirees are only eligible for two of the offered CalPERS medical plans, a Kaiser option and a PPO option, which are the most expensive plans offered for out-of-state coverage. The public comment suggested offering an additional agency contribution for those retirees living out of state. The committee and staff committed to review this topic and look at options at a future meeting. The committee discussed this item at its October 24th meeting. The process of reviewing the retiree contribution topic started with a survey of our comparable benchmark agencies. They were asked if they treated their out-of-state retirees different than their in-state retirees, or if they offered a cash-in-lieu option for those retirees who were covered under a separate medical plan, as was suggested in one of the public comments. Out of the 10 agencies that we surveyed, 8 responded. Those 8 that responded did not offer additional benefits to out-of-state retirees, and none of those agencies of the 8 offered a cash in lieu option for waiving coverage. 3 of the 8, however, of the survey respondents contribute to a health reimbursement account for retirees to use to pay for medical coverage in retirement. Retirees have the option of staying with their agency health plan, whether it's or with our benchmark agencies, it's either CalPERS or Aqua JPIA, and use those funds accumulated in the HRA to pay the monthly premiums, or they can use the HRA to purchase their own insurance or to pay for medical-related expenses. Seeing the HRA option was used for retiree benefits for some of our comparable agencies, we thought that might be an option to provide flexibility to our retirees. Staff consulted with our legal counsel, as well as the third-party administrator that the agency uses for the Board of Directors HRA, to see if implementing a retiree HRA option would work. It was concluded that yes, the agency can create a retiree HRA. For those retirees who want to keep their CalPERS medical plan, that is still in place and retirees do not need to do anything. For those retirees that are seeking flexibility, staff provided 2 additional retiree options for consideration in the board report tonight. For those retirees who are eligible to receive the CalPERS medical benefit but may live out of state or are covered under another medical plan, they would have 2 options to choose from. Under option 1, those retirees would need to opt out of the CalPERS medical plan and they would receive their eligible agency contribution as a deposit into a retiree HRA account to pay for medical premiums or medical expenses. Or under option two, those retirees would opt out of the CalPERS medical plan and receive their eligible agency contribution in the form of cash in lieu. The HRA contribution is a non-taxable benefit to the retiree, whereas the cash in lieu would be a taxable benefit. So for example, in either option one or two, they would both benefit the retiree by allowing them to purchase medical insurance in their state that may be at a lower cost than the PERS Platinum PPO. The retiree would be able to use the HRA contribution or the cash in lieu to purchase a lower cost medical coverage, which may avoid additional retiree contributions. Another example, if a retiree is dual covered, meaning they are covered under a spouse's medical plan, as well as receiving the agency's retiree benefit through CalPERS, that retiree could choose to opt out of the CalPERS medical plan and the eligible agency contribution deposited into an HRA to offset medical expenses such as deductibles, copays, prescriptions, etc. Or take the cash in lieu option to pay for expenses not eligible under the HRA, such as a home care provider. There are several pros and cons to each option, and the retiree would need to choose the option that works best in their situation. Neither of these proposed options provide for additional agency contribution to those retirees residing out of state, but could provide additional flexibility based on the retiree's needs and circumstances. CalPERS allows retirees to opt out of their medical coverage, but does not rule out the option of opting back in if the retiree situation changes. So retirees can opt back into CalPERS at any time if there has been a qualifying event, meaning that they've lost coverage, or if there is not a qualifying event, they can opt back in during any open enrollment period. For those retirees who would like to opt out of the CalPERS medical plan and participate in the agency's retiree HRA, which is option one, the cost would be approximately $3.90 per month per retiree. So we used an example in the board report that if 20% of the agency's 66 retirees chose option one, the annual cost to the agency would be approximately $608. A majority of the FNA committee recommended adding flexibility to the agency's retiree benefit policy, but did direct staff to confirm with agency counsel that the HRA could pay for retiree medical insurance premiums and not just medical expenses. It was confirmed by the agency's legal counsel and the benefits counsel from the third-party administrator that, yes, a retiree HRA can cover both medical expenses and individual health premiums. The Finance Administration Committee recommends that the Board of Directors approve revising Employee Manual Number 18, Other Benefits, as shown in the board report, to provide agency retirees with medical plan options in retirement. And that concludes my report.
Thank you, Rochelle. Madam Secretary, do we have any public comment? I don't have any comment cards at the moment.
We do not.
Very good. We can open up to board discussion. Director Colley.
I have a clarifying question first. On page 110 of the board packet, 109, 110, the draft revision is paragraphs 18.9.1 and paragraphs 18.9.2. Is it your, am I supposed to read this as that would be, all those changes in red would be all in the new employee manual?
Yeah, the end or would be removed. It was an option if we were going to just have option one, it would be 18.9.1. And if option one and two were approved, we would leave 18.9.2.
Okay, so when I attended the meeting and I actually went back and listened to the recording, and best I can understand, the committee thought that option, the HRA option, should be offered to employees. I don't think that there was ever in the committee a proposal to have both available to retired employees. And so I don't think it's accurate to say that the committee recommended the changes of both options, including options one and two. I believe the committee intended to have option one. So I'd like to sort of figure out what the recommendation is first, and then go from there a little bit. But
I would ask the committee chair to perhaps comment on what the recommendation of the committee was.
I believe there was a request to expand the knowledge a little bit more, and the option came up in the expansion. I think at the meeting originally it was set up for option one. I don't necessarily see that that creates a problem if it's voted on here, but I understand your language talking about that. It recommends the board to approve the revising. It doesn't distinguish whether it's option one or two. Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, if the committee is going to do the heavy lifting on this, I think the committee's recommendation is important. So the committee's recommendation, as I understood it, was to do an HRA. So I don't know if any other committee members want to.
Yeah, sure.
Director Armitage, go ahead.
So my recollection and what I'd prefer, so maybe this is why I remember it this way, is I think we should offer the flexibility of both. I mean, I don't see a downside. Is there a downside to offering both options and that additional flexibility?
Okay. Well, first, that would be one of the things we keep saying is that we want to be on par with all the other agencies, and this would be putting us absolutely in front. It would be a more generous, and it costs more money. Okay. So everything we do that provides something of monetary value to the employees of the agency, and including the retired employees, costs money. And that money comes only from ratepayers. And so is there a disadvantage to charging ratepayers for extra benefits? I believe there is.
Director Gutsai.
I was at the committee, and my recollection is both were discussed and approved, because I remember the issue with one being taxable. So I remember approving both at the committee. If that was the question, and I support the committee's recommendation of approving both tonight.
Okay. All right. Can I?
Director Planbeck, hold on, Ed, I'll get back to you. Director Planbeck, go ahead.
Well, I would like to hear the difference in cost, because now I've heard people talk about that, but not really any specifics. I think you said 608 or something, but I didn't quite understand that, if that was per person or how much it was actually going to really cost. But I do want to say I'm so grateful to you for finding a way of possibly resolving this, because I was concerned about retirement and moving out of state. It didn't seem like a fair thing to do. A lot of people will be moving out of state after retirement.
The added cost, the true cost to the agency, there are underlying costs to option two, which is administrative, is the $608. That's if it's $3.90 per retiree per month. If they chose the HRA option. Right now there's 66 retirees, which equated to the $608 a year. The amount is the same. So however much we are contributing to the CalPERS as their benefit would be either contributed to the HRA or contributed as cash in lieu. It wouldn't be any different, although it would be a little bit heavier lift in administrative costs on the cash in lieu side, because we would either have to be cutting a check every month or an ACH, and then also issuing a 1099 at the end of the year.
Thank you. It just seems like 600 is pretty minimal.
Go ahead, Director Colley.
So to clarify, if a retired employee does not spend the entire amount of their HRA, where does the excess money go?
In the plan, we can set it to roll over.
And if it rolls over and it caps out and still doesn't get used, where does the excess money go?
It does not come back to the agency. It's similar to a flexible spending account. There are several options that we can pick when we set up the plan. It can be a user will lose it, so they'd have to use it in the calendar year, or we could set up a specific dollar amount that would roll over, whether it's $500 or $1,000, or you can set up to where it would roll over every month or every year.
So you're telling me that excess funds that are not spent out of an HRA would never come back to the agency?
That's not my understanding. It's the retiree's account.
So it is your understanding. I'm not sure. Does the excess money out of an HRA ever come back to the agency?
No.
Okay. And so where does it go?
It would either be rolled over into the next year into the retiree's HRA, or it could be set up to a use it or lose it, similar to the flexible spending account.
Okay. So if the money is, let's assume we did the use it or lose it and the employee loses it. Okay, and the employee loses $100. Who gets the $100?
Yeah, I'm not sure. Ari, do you know?
Yeah.
Okay, that's what I thought.
If it's
okay.
So those are the options that you can pick.
Okay, so it's an HRA. If the money is not spent, it comes back to the agency, so an HRA can be less expensive. So I just wanted to, it took me a minute. I'm sorry to, I understood that, but I apparently was having difficulty getting that across. So the HRA is less expensive. I have another issue with the cash in lieu in general. The general manager sometime in the last year kind of brought this subject up. The fact that when we provide health insurance for a single employee, an employee who does not have any significant other, he gets something. And if you have a significant other and they have health insurance, now you can convert, instead of getting health insurance isn't worth anything, you can get cash for it, which provides something in my mind just pretty grossly unfair to our single employees. And so generally in cash in lieu, I think that we ought to be considering that pretty hard about when it is allowed and if it should be allowed at the same rate as somebody who has a significant other. It does cost more for the cash in lieu. I'm not in favor of it. I guess I'll leave it at that.
Director Guzek.
I just want to clarify something that was just said. The HRA would cost less, as Director Colley said, if it is set to be, potentially if it's set to be use it or lose it, but that decision isn't before us tonight, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so it could be, which actually I would favor, perpetually rolling over, but it is my understanding, restricted to designated health expenses, which is why it's tax-free to the employee. As opposed to cash, they could save up and buy a car if they want it.
Correct.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure what we were deciding, but I remain supportive. I think $608 a year is a reasonable administrative expense, and we shouldn't be penalizing people that are moving out of state either. So that's the way I look at it. Thank you.
Director Kelly.
I just wanted to emphasize that the 608 is an estimate based on the 20%. If 100% of the 66 people took it, we'd be looking at give or take 2,000, you know, on a year. So I just didn't want us to stick to the point that it's 608. It's whatever it's going to be. It could be 300. It could be 2,000.
Okay. Thank you, Director Kelly. Any other? Oh, down here. Vice President Ozahusky.
Okay. A couple of questions. On page 103, we have a table, years of service and percent of employer contributions. I imagine that during the onboarding of new hire, benefits are explained to our employees. Is that correct?
In detail.
Okay. There's annual enrollment every year where every single employee has to receives that email from HR and chooses to change their enrollment status or keep it the same. Is that correct?
Correct.
All right. And are there any kind of reminders with our long-term employees about their benefits and the status of the benefits past 5-10 years? Well, let me rephrase. Can any employee have easy access to our HR department explaining to them their benefits within SCV Water?
Yes.
Have there been any complaints about not having a conversation with an HR representative about their benefits, to the best of your knowledge?
To the best of my knowledge, no.
Okay, understood. Thank you. That's all for me. Back to you, President Martin.
Thank you. Director Ford.
Thank you, President Martin. We have a cash in lieu for active employees. And how does it compare to what would be the second alternative here? Dollar amount the same or more or less? Or
it depends on whatever the retiree is eligible for. If it's individual coverage, if it is a couple coverage, also if they are Medicare eligible and only receiving the supplement. So for retirees, it's based on their eligibility, whichever plan they would be eligible for.
Yeah. And when you talk about the tax consequences, there would be no tax consequences to the agency itself. It's just the individual that would receive the cash in lieu.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Welcome, Director Cooper. Let me bring you up to speed on where we are with this item. Director Colley questioned whether this is on the HRA and cash in lieu benefit for out-of-state, item 6.1. And so there's a question about what the committee actually recommended. And I think the consensus of the committee members was that they recommended an either or, the options one and option two, one HRA or one cash in lieu. And so we're kind of debating or discussing the pros and cons of both of those options and where we go from here. There's been no motion made. And so I think we've had a full round of comments. So I'd like to ask Rochelle, the whole purpose of the benefit is to provide our retired employees with healthcare coverage.
Correct.
And HRA would seem to do that. To the dollar limit that all of our retirees get.
Yes.
And so it seems like that accomplishes the purpose. Does that, in the staff report, we talk about two out-of-state employees who brought this issue up in public comment. And in your view, Rochelle, does, if we went with just the HRA option, does that in fact satisfy the concerns that were brought up by the two out-of-state retirees?
Yes. I don't know the actual cost for individual health coverage in those states. I did look up one state. It seemed like The amount that would be deposited into the HRA would cover an individual plan in that state. And then they could have a little bit extra left over for co-pays or deductibles in the HRA. But I can't say 100% sure with their state.
And my other observation about the cash in lieu, in reading the staff report, staff would then have to issue checks, issue 1099s, and keep track of the financial side of that. Probably seems to me like it's a little more effort than the HRA process, but
probably more than $3.90 a month.
Yeah. Okay. Director Cooper, did you want to weigh in on this item? Everyone else seems to have had an opportunity to talk.
I read over the item, and I thought that the HRA was a good solution to it. I thought that was excellent. I didn't have any problem with staff's recommendation.
Okay.
Just to be clear, I think the staff was recommending both options, and that's what I remember from the committee. Was HRA or cash in lieu the retiree's choice? So I think we're debating. Well, I'll go ahead and move that we approve the staff recommendation, which is adding the HRA and cash in lieu option. So I'll just put that out on the table.
Okay. We have a motion from Director Gutzeit.
I'll second that.
Uh-oh, this could be trouble. Director Armitage.
I'll second the motion.
So we have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion on this before we call for the vote? Madam Secretary, please call the roll.
As I call your name, please state how you vote. Director Bronstein.
Yes.
Director Cooper.
Yes.
Director Gutzeit.
Yes.
Director Kelly.
Yes.
Director Armitage.
Yes.
Director Plambeck.
Yes.
Director Cawley.
No.
Director Ford.
Yes.
Director Peterson.
Yes.
Vice President Ozahowski.
Yes.
President Martin.
Yes.
Thank you. This item does pass.
All right. Thank you, Board. We now can move on to item 6.2. This is presented tonight by Sustainability Manager Matt Dickens. This item is the staff report, and attachments for this item were sent out yesterday by email, posted to the website, authorized the general manager to execute a construction contract for the Bridgeport Pocket Park. Mr. Dickens.
Thank you, President Martin, and members of the committee, or excuse me, members of the board. I'm Matt Dickens, Sustainability Manager for SCV Water. Tonight I'll be presenting on the Bridgeport Pocket Park, demonstrating smart, sustainable gardens in the SCV. In addition to my presentation, there is a packet that the staff provided for the board. And this item was taken before the Water Resources and Watershed Committee, and staff's recommendation to move this to the board was agreed upon by consensus. Next slide, please. So tonight's presentation objectives, of course, are to recommend the SCV Water Board of Directors authorize the general manager to execute a construction contract for Bridgeport Pocket Park. I'll provide a review of the size, scope, and the design process. I'll review the overview of the RFP and lowest cost proposal, review updated project strategic objectives and value added, and then we'll conclude with conclusions and answers and questions. Next slide, please. So the Pocket Park's been a project that my team and myself and our collaborative team have been working on for quite some time. It had launched in 2018 and 2019 when the agency launched and asked our conservation team to develop a strategy for the conservatory garden. As part of that process, we looked at some of the challenges with the conservatory garden as a demonstration garden, and it came up with the strategy of taking sustainable drought-tolerant landscapes and water efficiency technologies and practices to the community. So with that, we partnered up with members of the city of Santa Clarita to identify various different sites to conduct a criterion analysis matrix to determine the optimal park that had visibility, accessibility, and that was currently something that the park could provide the land and space for us to put the demonstration garden on. I'll talk about that a little more in a minute. In 2019, SCV Water and the City of Santa Clarita signed a memorandum of understanding, agreeing on the basic principles and the operations of the park, as well as the location of the park. Then in 2019, we started our collaborative garden site design process, and I'll talk about that. It's a very innovative process that was quite a learning lesson, but very, very innovative and very successful in the outcomes. And then in 2020-21, we did our site engineering support for grading and other types of upgrades. And then in 2022, we received requests for proposals. Next slide, please. So first I'll talk about the criterion analysis that the SCV Water staff and City of Santa Clarita staff looked at. We evaluated 8 different sites across the valley that seemed suitable based off of city operations for the construction of a demonstration pocket park. Those included Discovery Park, Bridgeport Park, Valencia Meadows, Creek View, Camp Plenty, Magic Mountain Trailhead, Oak Springs Park, Canyon Country Community Center. From those sites, based off of the criterion analysis matrix where we looked at various different types of attributes, again, accessibility, location, participation, population that visits the park, those types of components, Bridgeport Pocket Park was selected. Next slide, please. So turning to the park site details, Bridgeport Pocket Park, Bridgeport Park is located near Bridgeport Elementary School. You can see in the picture here the area that the city, during the last drought, cut off irrigation to. It used to be a grass area similar to the softball field just to the north or northwest. It's approximately 16,000 square feet. It hosts about 16,000 visitors annually. That's from 6 special events with 300 to 500 attendees per event. It has sport and activity use all year round, general recreation, and school functions with Bridgeport Elementary Schools. You can see it buds right up to one of their playgrounds. And from the assessment criteria, this was a prime venue for the construction of this facility. Next slide, please. So again, to the design scope, this was a very collaborative process where, again, SCV Water staff, representatives from the City of Santa Clarita Parks Division, as well as 4 local landscape designers. These are designers that we work with regularly to assist our residential customers with their lawn replacement program designs. So we thought this was a great opportunity to show various different types of styles and aesthetics and preferences so that our customers could see the types of landscapes that they could transition to from high water use turf. It incorporated drought-tolerant native plants, high-efficiency spray and drip irrigation, and additional features included sustainability features such as rainwater gardens, entrance and plant signs, a permeable concrete pad that could be used for additional programming and education, as well as for servicing of the park and maintenance of the park, as well as paths and benches. So it's kind of a museum-type garden, but you can see more of the design scope if you look in the table to the right. Next slide, please. This gives you an idea. This is essentially this is the entire site, but it shows the irrigation plan as well as the walking paths. This is split into 4 different unique sections where the designers were able to showcase, again, drought-tolerant, water-efficient landscaping, water-efficient irrigation, other types of features that they might promote to customers that they've worked with, our customers they've worked with. There's about 4 different entrances in the park. It creates kind of a walking, again, museum and engagement and interactive experience for customers to walk around, look at different styles, look at different plants, get a good feel of what could be done in their yards. Next slide, please. So in August 2022, Conservation, Sustainability, and Engineering launched the request for proposals via Planet Bids. We received proposals in September, and those four proposals that we received are shown in the table to the right. And the lowest cost bid was selected, and that came from CS Legacy Construction at $373,147.60. Next slide, please. So again, this kind of restates some of that information, but I think what's important to note here on the table to the right is that we broke down the bid by various different elements, including construction, engagement, signage, irrigation, non-plant landscape, pathways and paths, plants and services. We identified the total cost per element, cost per square foot, the percentage of the cost of the total project. And then we also identified, based off of committee recommendations, on what type of costs residential customers might see in their types of projects. And so that's listed in that table. It is important to note that the 373 is higher than the 230,000 that staff budgeted and planned for this project. And that's based off of a number of realities that kind of popped up here. One includes that when staff developed this project, we were considering and approaching it from a residential or a typical type of conversion project, as opposed to one that would be more involved and more detailed criteria that a public works project might have. That includes those construction elements. And as you can see in the table to the right on the construction cost, which is a good 35% of the total park, typically that cost is something that I might do if I had a shovel on the weekend if we're a homeowner. So we know that those types of costs are sometimes borne out when contractors are hired. But in typical residential conversion projects, that's not the case. Further, most residential customers won't have landmark signs on their properties. Irrigation requires some conversion, but typically we're looking at about $1.25 per square foot because you can use the existing irrigation. In this case, because of the transition from athletic turf and the park's irrigation system, which has these really big rotors, to a more high efficient head-to-head coverage irrigation system for the new park, we had to redesign the whole irrigation system. So also in public works projects, there are things that we weren't aware of, prevailing wages. My team wasn't aware of, I should say. Economic conditions, inflation, which construction inflation, as last I checked, was up 15%. And then, of course, there's demonstration garden aesthetics, having those, again, signs and benches and whatnot. Next slide, please. So turning to the Bridgeport Pocket Park's strategic objectives, the demonstration garden promotes drought-tolerant and water-efficient landscapes out into the community, which is one of the strategic measures in our the SCV Water Strategic Plan. It also communicates with customers that conservation is a way of life, which is another measure in the strategic plan. But additionally, it creates collaboration and partnership opportunities with the city of Santa Clarita. I'll dive into that a little more here shortly. It integrates demonstration functions with existing parks. Currently, there are not many, if any. It improves community access to demonstration garden. Currently, customers can come to visit the conservatory garden, but only on business hours, and they have to go through security and check in at the front gate. So if you're working in the city, it may be very difficult to ever engage with that type of landscape coming here at a site that's mostly used for night adult classes as well as child education programs. So with that, it enhances our education programming, offering us a place to work with the school, work with local landscape contractors for training, as well as to hold events to promote this type of landscape to the community. And at the end of the day, it converts that once-used turf area to sustainable, drought-tolerant, water-efficient landscaping. Next slide, please. So in terms of the value added, there are three things that I assessed when developing this slide, and that is education, location, and collaboration. So regarding education, SCB Water Conservation staff conducted a survey of our customers and an analysis of our lawn replacement program in 2020. And it was determined from a survey of more than 1,500 customers that one of the biggest needs our customers have when it comes to water efficient, drought tolerant landscaping are examples, places that they can go to see these types of landscapes in plant, literally. Also, we have, again, partnership with the elementary school. And of course, it leverages the conservation garden and other facilities so that we can look at those missions, leverage those facilities, and continue to provide more variability and variety of opportunities for customers to engage with these types of landscapes. In terms of location, again, the park offers prime real estate. I think about where could we build a park where we would have already active 16,000 participants per year visiting that site. That's a really valuable piece of dirt to put a water efficient landscape demonstration garden on. It'd be very difficult for us to create that type of visitor population without having it already ingrained and embedded in the system. Not impossible, but very difficult. And again, it's open 365 days, weekends and holidays. And then I think the last piece on the collaboration is that this is, a long-term project where we've worked very, very diligently and for numerous years with the City of Santa Clarita and their staff. The City of Santa Clarita, again, provided us that landscape at a place where they have that many people visiting their sites for use for water-efficient landscape demonstration garden. And so with that, that provides us another partner to help promote those gardens to the public. Not just from the agency promoting water efficiency to the public, but now the city will have on its property a water efficient landscape garden that it too can promote out to the public. So you have two public entities that can be promoting that type of landscape to the community. Very, very valuable. So with that, and in conclusion, SCB Water staff recommends that the SCB Water Board of Directors authorize the general manager to execute a construction contract for Bridgeport Pocket Park, and I'd be happy to answer any questions from the board.
Thank you, Matt, very much for the presentation. Excellent. Madam Secretary, do we have any public comment? I don't have any public comment cards.
We do, just one moment.
Okay. We can open up for board discussion.
We do have a public comment. Just one moment, President Martin.
Okay.
Ms. Cattell, go ahead and hit start, or please go ahead and begin your public comment. Ms. Cattell?
Yes, I was waiting to unmute. Thank you. This looks like a wonderful idea, and I'm very glad that we will be seeing this wonderful experiment in our community. If it's successful, I hope we will add one in Canyon Country and in Newhall, and maybe have a second one in Saugus at a more accessible park. As far as the fountain, I think that's great, one that has access for a water bottle. And I like that very interesting apparatus they have on Bouquet behind the Starbucks, where they have this wonderful little bicycle, I guess it would be almost a repair center where you can clamp your bicycle, you have a place to get a drink of water, and you also have a place where your dog can get a drink of water. So I hope that will be part of the park on the park right next to the bike path. Thank you very much. Great idea.
Thank you. There is no further public comment.
Very good. Thank you, Sandra. Director Bernstein.
Thank you. First of all, I love this idea. I think I've been one of the people that have been saying, but show me. So I think this is a really, I love this. I have two small questions. One is the location is right next to a children's playground. We're going to have a lot of bees, just making sure that that's not an issue. And my other question is, do we have a commitment from the city that they're going to leave it that way too? You know, like, is there some kind of agreement that this will stay, like, with all our investment in it?
Thank you, Director Bronstein. To your first question on the impact of bees, we did assess in our criterion analysis and during the design process the likelihood of bees, and we checked it of visiting the park and the impact of being close to the kids. And the park staff advised us that that was kind of ceteris paribus, I guess, or similar to an issue that kind of exists already. So the idea there is that there's not there's attraction to bees, but not necessarily one that's far greater than what was already kind of existing at the park. So the so that issue remains the same, and that the school has had a little problem from what they were able to define with that issue. So it's a park. The second issue is the MOU has a start date of 5 years post-construction. And so that's what we have documented on the MOU. So with that, that doesn't mean we can't reevaluate and reassess, but that was the terms that we put into the MOU.
Thank you. Because I just figure if we're investing all this money, we want to make sure that it actually stays like we want it to be, not demolished in 5 years and something else happens to it.
Great point. And I don't think that it's a matter of it would be demolished in 5 years. It may, they may take whole ownership of the park in 5 years.
Okay. Which then will not be our responsibility at all. And
that's, again, that can be renegotiated, but in this MOU, the term was set for 5 years.
Okay.
That seemed to be a standard clause in their agreement.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Director Armitage.
Thank you. Thank you for your presentation, and thank you for the larger sheets for the plans, because when it was on the smaller sheet, I think a lot of us were struggling to understand the details. So thank you for that. So I think this is a really important component, and I see this as an investment as part of the lawn replacement program that we are pushing here at the agency. I think, as you mentioned, there's a lot of interest, I think probably more than we even realize, in people wanting to replace maybe parts of their lawns, maybe all of their lawns, with drought tolerant and native plants, but they just don't know what to do. I am a native plant enthusiast, and I still am not sure what I want to do 2 years into my planning process. So I think this would be extremely helpful to customers who are looking to take that on. I think that I agree that I think this is a really good placement for a starter pocket park. Has a lot of visibility. Kids are there all the time, all hours of the day. As a former soccer mom and cross country mom, my kids have spent a lot of time. I have spent a lot of time at that park, so I think it's a great location. And I think the collaborations that will happen through this with the city are really important, because I'm hoping that they will understand the importance of using drought tolerant and native plants more and more throughout their own projects that are even separate from us, which could potentially save lots of water in the future. And I'm really excited about the collaborative potential with the school nearby too for the students. So I'm very supportive of this. And I'll say it again, I can't stress enough how important I think that we make sure that we have people that are part of this project who understand native plants really well. And I know we've talked about that, and that is going to be brought on. So, but I just want to say it again. So thank you. And I'm supportive of this.
Vice President Ozahusk.
Yeah, it's very difficult to gauge the return on investment on this monetary wise, but I think this will be if the board decides to move forward with this, perhaps we can use this as a PR campaign and send editorials to Home and Garden magazines, maybe possibly win some awards and be up for some awards. I was wondering if Mr. Dickens, if you can work with outreach program and see if we can do that upon completion. That could be one of our paths forward, you know, with no objections from directors. And then other questions here. So Hunter MP Rotors 800, are those readily available at Home Depot and Lowe's? Irrigation system.
So the MP rotators are readily available in the public. At Home Depot, the big box stores, Lowe's. Sometimes they're maybe not as front shelf as I'd like them to be. But at all of our irrigation supply houses, they are stocked by the thousands at any time. Yeah.
Okay. Understood. And same questions for all the native plants that we're going to be using this. Are they readily available at, you know, brand name stores like Home Depot and Lowe's?
Another great question, Director Ozerhofsky. The big box stores have yet to adopt the native plant pallets. They have been adopting the water-wise plants. You've probably seen the big signs out, succulents and some drought tolerant and some natives. But right now, part of this process, part of our larger logic model process for this program is to develop those supply chains by creating demand. So by creating demand for native plants, by creating partnerships with local nurseries and the supply chain, we can help bring those plants out to the forefront to get them better shelf placement.
Okay, understood. All right. I know I've sent an email to you and Ms. Jacobs really late. It was today, mid-afternoon. But you've shared with me a presentation that you gave in 2019 to the board, where you explained the concept of this project.
Yes, sir.
Ms. Jacobs, do you by any chance have that PowerPoint available? Excellent. If you can go to slide 15.
A couple of things on this, Director Ozerhofsky. I was younger, and this is pre-pandemic.
No, it's, you don't have to worry. All right. So, directors, we can look at option A. So there were different options presented to the board at that time. This was, as Mr. Dickens mentioned, a park that would be built in Rio Vista, which again has limited access to the public, and the estimated cost at that time was $3.5 million. If you can go to option B, Ms. Jacobs. So this was a plan for Central Park. Again, it was going to be a full development, which would bring the price to close to $4 million. And because of the lighting situation, I believe it wouldn't be that safe at during the nighttime. And again, not really readily accessible to the public.
And right? The city's constructing on that property. So that's being built out by city of Santa Clarita. Yeah.
So that's not even an option. Yeah. And then if you can click on slide 19, Jacobs, this was option C, which was, well, let's create some pocket parks. Close to, you know, populated areas with a lot of foot traffic, where we can show what these native species plants could look like and with, what kind of irrigation they would require. And the decision of the board that time, it is my understanding that they went with option C. Is that not correct?
That was the guidance we received. Yes, sir.
And the estimated cost for that one was $1.4 million at that time. So the current cost, I don't have the number in front of me, Mr. Dickens. What is the current cost for Bridgeport Park?
Bridgeport Park is $373 and change.
Okay. So it's going with the option C that the board has decided to move forward with, and it's below the estimated cost. Again, not taking into effect the square footage and all the logistics and all of that. But it seems like we're moving in the right way here. Although I would emphasize that the return on investment here should be public relations, education, and sending it to as many magazines, Home and Garden magazines as possible to get some sort of traction here. That's all my comments. Back to you, President Martin. Thank you, Jacobs.
So, Director Ozerhofsky, if I may add a point of clarification. The 1.4 million looked at the breaking, the moving down based off of square footage cost of from moving from the entire build out of the conservatory garden down to a smaller demonstration garden here at the facility, plus pocket parks. I would note that since that time, with the change of the mission and the vision of the conservatory garden, that price is, it looks much different. I would say it's more around the $3.8 million for both, because of the new landscaping, not just new landscaping at the conservatory garden, but also it has state-of-the-art education exhibits, including a scaled model of the State Water Project and an amazing exhibit of our local aquifers. It's got facilities. So it's transitioning from just a garden to a state-of-the-art education training center and a facility for event facility. So there is a change of mission in that initial estimates that were provided in the presentation there, just for clarification.
Thank you. Thank you for that detail.
Director Kelly.
We have a shortage of funds, and you're looking at diverting some funds from the conservation gardens to make this work. So my question is, are we giving anything up on the conservation gardens by giving up these funds? Are we spreading anything farther out on the conservation gardens? What exactly is going to happen on that side of the fence if we divert 140,000 or 143,000 over to the pocket park?
Thank you, Director Kelly. That's a great question. And I'll have, we did under budget the pocket park by 140,000, as you stated. And we do have available money that won't be used this year on the conservatory garden. So we think we can use from that budget. We do need to reassess the budget for the conservatory garden education experience. Currently, we're at the 90% design completion, and we're updating our engineering estimates. So I'll have a better understanding of those types of impacts here very shortly. But I don't believe that would take out a specific component. Rather, we're looking at, like I said, updating our engineering estimates and then also conducting value engineering to determine where we can find the best cost savings for that vision.
So this reevaluation would take place in the 23-24 budget?
If there was an update to it, yes, sir.
Thank you.
Director Goodsay.
Yeah, just a couple comments from Water Resources. I mean, we talked about this pretty extensively, and to the budget issue, you know, we went over that as to what happened, and I think have an agreement that we'll try not to have that happen again so that the board isn't surprised by the changes. But overall, the committee was supportive of this. And one thing I did want to ask, just for transparency, the public commenter talked about a water fountain, and at the committee, we talked about that dropping out and possibly some other small things dropping out. I was just looking at these drawings. I remember also there was like interim ground cover that isn't going to happen. We're dropping a few things, I believe, including the water fountain, because right next to this, literally across the sidewalk, as a bathroom with two, not only sinks, but also two water fountains where you can fill your water bottle. So, but can you just clarify that so that the caller, you know, isn't surprised?
Oh, absolutely. So in the design criteria, we did assess the viability of a water bottle fill station. That was dropped from the design because, as you mentioned, there's a bathroom and drinking water facility right feet away. Whether or not they have a bottle refill station there, as opposed to your classic drinking fountain, is something I think we can coordinate with the city to identify and perhaps make some recommendations and partner there to provide more accessible human and dog drinking fountain features.
I have the dogs drinking.
Go ahead, Director Peterson.
Matt,
when I first started working at the Valencia Water Company, you're working on the Rockefeller garden, which was a very nice project when it was all done. How do you feel how that has survived the 5 years since that time, and how we what have you learned about maintenance coming up on this park, as you say?
Director Peterson, thank you. It's a pleasure to see you here tonight. Thank you for that question. Yeah, the garden redesign project at Rockefeller, I think it has some amazing moments where some things really panned out well. Some other components, not so much. Specifically, the buffalo grass. So this facility doesn't incorporate any buffalo grass. It's very difficult to get planted without a lot of care. Wonderful grass. It's a great grass, a very low water use grass. But in terms of our subsurface irrigation, it didn't pan out well in that corner. But I think that what I learned from that was initially when we designed that project, a lot of staff felt that drought tolerant California native plants were the weeds that you might run into walking through an alleyway, just nicely placed. And so what I can tell you, though, is that shortly after designing that garden, a lot of those folks who have that mentality and have that mentality shared with our community really thought it was a beautiful place to congregate, to come to work. It attracted new butterflies. And we had an egret, I think. One time I was afraid to go to my car because the egret was standing next to it for longer than I was with, but we had, again, butterflies, and we had a buffet happening out front, which was a great thing, and it provided a great opportunity, like it's a great space for staff to go and sit, customers to come and look at, and something that was inspirational. So we learned quite a bit from it. It does need a champion, and I think part of this MOU, we have supplemental, but also we have basic plus supplemental maintenance. The basic maintenance, the city will be looking at trash. They'll be looking at, picking up trash, picking up weeds, making sure the mulching is there, missing things are put back, irrigation breaks are corrected. But we are planning, the agency will have supplemental eyes on that to make sure that the native plants, which do require a little bit more TLC, are going to get that while they're growing.
Thank you, Matt.
Sir.
Director Colley.
Just briefly, one of the things we did discuss at the committee was the Central Park, and we were told that it was not favored by the city because they wanted every bit of the real estate that's down there. I would have preferred that if we think it's important to have the maximum possible public participation, the Central Park is the park. It's the one that people will come from Canyon Country, from Newhall. From every corner of our valley, they will go to Central Park. And if that was important, we should have maybe leaned on the city a little harder to find a place there. The price of this really is shocking. On a per acre basis, this is a little over $1 million an acre. And no homeowner is going to come remotely close, I don't think, to spending that kind of money. And so if we're modeling something that costs something close to $1 million an acre, I think the homeowner might just go home and look and say, well, not going to do it. So the committee did ask for the cost to maybe come down. When it came back the second time, the cost didn't come down, and we just got more explanation on why the cost can't come down. So I would prefer that, We cut costs somewhere someday. We need to prioritize where we spend our money. I mean, we talk about the wonderful words up there that end in reasonable cost. And if we just keep spending money, reasonable cost is just not possible.
Director Planbeck.
Yeah, one thing that was mentioned was multiple pocket parks. Are we still thinking about doing that, or is this going to be it?
Director Plumbeck, we do have other candidates that we assessed This is a pilot program, so depending on the outcome of this, it may certainly warrant and merit the evaluation and the expansion of Pocket Parks throughout the community. But at this point in time, it's a pilot project so that we can learn, assess, and adapt.
I have to say, I agree a little bit with Director Colley that I love this pilot program, but I just feel like Water District maybe shouldn't be in the park business. I'm having a little trouble with that.
Director Cooper.
Thank you, President Martin. I don't quite remember the Water Resources Committee exactly the same as Director Colley. We asked them to come back and give us a better breakdown on the cost. It wasn't to come back and cut the cost. It was to give us a better understanding of the cost. And they did that. The things that, you know, we're building up a commercial exhibit for people to get some ideas on how to use native plants to better benefit the valley. This isn't a homeowner's backyard. This is a commercial endeavor. And if we look at the costs of those that Mr. Dickens showed us, the hardscape costs are about $160,000. That's pouring concrete sidewalks. That's putting up signage. That's doing the parking area that's to be a rainwater flow through parking structure. So there's a lot of hardscape that goes to this. And if we're going to do something that we want to impress upon people how their backyards or their front yards can look and use less water, it's expensive. The construction costs, we have to pay prevailing wage. And prevailing wage for a laborer to just go out there and dig is $63 an hour. For somebody to drive a tractor, it's more. For electricians, it's more. For pipe fitters, it's more than that. So to think that we're going to try to make this look like something that the homeowner could go out and build is not what it's doing. And I think this is a good example. I mean, the board is the one that said, let's do pocket parks. And now we've come back with the cost, and we got a little bit shocked by it, but they came back and explained to us that it's going to be more expensive than what a homeowner's is. And that I think if we want to do this in the future at other parks, we have to have something that can give us a good example of whether people are paying attention to it or not. So, well, yes, I agree that the costs are high. I understand the costs. And to me, to the board, the question is, do you want to do pocket parks or not? If you're going to say, let's do them at $100,000 for this thing, then let's just get out of the business of it completely, because I don't want us to be a part of something that's going to look like it was built by the guys that are standing in front of Home Depot. I want us to do something that looks good for the agency and is impressive to the community. So I think this is a good program, and I hope that we move it forward.
Move the recommended action.
Thank you, Director Cooper. Is that a motion, Director Cusack?
I would second that motion.
All right, so we've got a motion and a second, but I think Director Ford had something he'd like to say.
Yes, just the usual. We did hear this at Water Resources, and we had it came twice, and was worth repeating. Matt Dickens did a good job both times, and I think he explained in exhaustive detail as to the benefits that we would accrue as a result of this. But I want to emphasize one thing as well, too, that the city has been a good partner throughout the years in terms of water conservation. It would be very easy for them to just say, you know, that's your bailiwick, we'll let you handle this, but they're not. They've been actively involved, and we want to keep working with them collaboratively in that regard. And I think this is a good project just to do that. And their contribution to this is not insignificant. It's 16,000 square feet of outstanding land, a lot of traffic, a lot of attractive features surrounding it, and a commitment on their part, certainly for 5 years and probably longer, to help us to maintain this as well, too. So it is an expensive project. We need to get 4 qualifying bids, and this is the lowest bid. And so I think it's money well spent in this case. And I will, it's already, the motion's already been here, but as the chair of the committee, I will vote yes on this as well.
Thank you, Director Ford. Director Armitage.
Thank you. Just a couple things to follow up on a couple comments that Vice President Ozahotsky had made in terms of availability of these types of plants at local nurseries. I'd like to think that the work that is being done by water conservation is actually moving the needle in terms of demand, because I will say that I was at a local, not one of the big box nurseries. It was a local smaller nursery. And I was actually impressed with the selection of native plants that they had available there, which I think has grown only recently. So I think that speaks to the work that's being done related to that. And in terms of also getting kind of recognition for this type of kind of forward-thinking project, I would ask that maybe we reach out to the California Native Plant Society to let them know what we're doing, and maybe they can help get recognition around this, and we would be considered kind of leaders in this area. And then, let's see, a couple more things. For the water, I know we talked about this in committee too, for the water refill station, I would just ask that we make sure that is somehow, whoever takes that on, I would just like to make sure we do have a way for people to fill their water bottles eventually there, or in the, you know, in the nearby or in the area. And then lastly, in terms of trying to get a feel for or gather feedback, I'm wondering if, I know you're going to have signage with like QR codes, I'm wondering if one of them could be like a virtual guest book where people can scan it and then like, yeah, sign in and share their thoughts about it or see how it's influenced them in any way. So I think that maybe would be kind of an interesting thing to add. Thank you.
Thank you. Matt, I'm going to have to ask you to stand up to the podium. I got a couple of nuts and bolts questions for you. And pardon me if you've already gone through some of this. I just may not have picked it up. This is being done on city-owned land. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So we have no other issues with ownership. And then going forward, what is our MOU say about our responsibilities after completion of construction and turn it over to the city?
President Martin, thank you for the questions. The MOU, again, it breaks down maintenance into basic and supplemental, where the city picks up the basic maintenance of trash pickup, weeding, mulching, irrigation repair, those types of things, in making sure the bench is cleared from debris and stuff like that so that it's usable for the park. The agency has what we've defined as supplemental, which is basically getting a professional native plant expert to be kind of looking at it periodically to make sure that it is progressing and growing as intended, providing a maintenance growth regime for us. In addition to that, there is some programming stipulations where we will coordinate with the city in certain types of programming, and they can say we're not really wanting to use a site for this type of programming. Not sure what that might include. Maybe a country rock festival. I don't know. It's not really walking on the landscape, but there's some coordination when it comes to certain types of programming.
Thank you, Matt. Appreciate the explanation. Yep. Do we have a budget for the ongoing maintenance, or is this done with the current staff? It's just kind of folded into our operational cost.
That has yet to be developed, but I don't see the cost being significant.
Okay. Yeah. Mr. Stone.
Yeah, I appreciate all the great questions, and Matt, your responsiveness, and stay there. I've got a question for you. it kind of occurred to me, and I'm sorry it just occurred because of the discussion, that it may or may not be helpful, but you had mentioned that the city previously had turf on this parcel and chose to take it out of service at some point to help with the drought. Had they come into us and applied for a turf replacement rebate, would they have been eligible for that? And had they gone and installed creeping drudgery or some kind of other attractive plant?
It's possible, General Manager Stone. But our discussions was that they were intending to return it to turf.
Okay. So at some point they could have converted it in the future.
They convert all their grass to the drought tolerant landscape.
Some kind of other landscape, but perhaps not as a demonstration of program. I'm just trying to point there's a little bit of value in that we're not issuing a rebate to the city. So we're sort of grinding that into our cost basis here. So
good point.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Matt. Appreciate your explanations on all the questions that we got. We do have a motion and a second. I have a feeling Director Colley's got something more to add.
Just that bringing up probably a question in my mind. Could somebody tell me what we do rebate for lawn replacement program? How much we're willing to give a homeowner for that?
Thank you, Director Colley. Our current program is set at $3 per square foot as a base rate, and then it goes to additional 50 cents per square foot for the use of native plants and half of your plant requirement. You can also stack it with 75 cents per square foot for converting to drip. And then there's other sustainability feature rebates that you can add to your project to increase that funding. But the base would be $3 per square foot.
All right, I think we are ready for a vote. We have a motion and a second. Madam Secretary, please call the roll.
As I call your name, please state how you vote. Director Planbeck.
Yes.
Director Cooper.
Yes.
Director Peterson.
Yes.
Director Gutzeit.
Yes.
Director Ford.
Yes.
Director Armitage.
Yes.
Director Colley.
No.
Director Kelly.
Yes.
Director Bronstein.
Yes.
Vice President Ozahofsky.
Yes.
President Martin.
Yes.
Thank you. This item does pass.
Thank you, staff, and thank you, board. We can move on to item 7, risk assessment presentation. And tonight it'll be presented by our Director of Operations and Maintenance, Mr. Mike Alford. Mr. Alford.
Thanks. And if I can just offer a pre-introduction for Mike. I know he's going to take us through a relaxation exercise or something, which we may need at this point. But this is. Wanted to know. I think there she is. Director Bronstein had asked this question quite some time ago in the context when we were discussing another project, Spring Canyon, and we were talking about our objective of trying to put together the right funding and approach to relocate some segments of sewer that are installed in the riverbed. They're protected, but they're installed in the riverbed to a more sustainable location in streets. And so the famous question was, are there any other things like the sewer in the river that we should know about? And that has been on our to-do list for quite some time. We have talked about it a number of times as a team, and Mike will go into that a little bit. What you see tonight is not necessarily the exhaustive list of everything we can think of that you don't know, but we turn this into more of an exercise of thinking about risk management and understanding kind of the categories of things that can come up unexpectedly. And I think Mike has a very engaging presentation, and the best part is you don't have to vote on anything on this. You can just listen and engage and ask questions. So thank you.
Thank you, President Martin and board members. And what General Manager Stone neglected to mention is, why am I giving the presentation?
That's risk management too.
It's because our executive staff voluntold me to do it. So this is, as Matt mentioned, this is not a risk assessment. This is not a comprehensive, all-inclusive list. It's a 30,000-foot view, but I do get into some of the detail of it. And I kind of like the interaction. So if you have questions, you want to interrupt me, I'm okay with that. If you want to wait until the end, I'm okay with that too. It shouldn't take the 45 minutes that was originally planned, unless there's a lot of questions. Next slide, please, April. So some of you might remember Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense, and he said this quote, and I think he was kind of ridiculed for saying it. And when I first heard it years ago, it did kind of sound odd, but if you think about it, it makes a ton of sense. There are known knowns. There are things we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know, but there are also unknown unknowns, the ones we don't know, we don't know. And I'll kind of explain that as we go through. And the next slide, please, was actually suggested by Matt, is this sort of ring that things that overlap, right? So there are a bunch of known risks. Property rights. When you own property, there's a risk. All of us that own property know there's risk to owning property. We're no different as an agency. There's a bunch of technology risks, cyber risks, malware, aging infrastructure. Right? The older the infrastructure gets, the more risk that it's going to fail. Regulatory violations. Doesn't mean we're always going to get them. Doesn't mean we're ever going to get them, but we have had them in the past, and there's some expectation that there might be some in the future. Worker safety. We have staff throughout the entire valley, probably over 100 at a time, that are out in the field exposed to traffic violations, exposed to traffic accidents, digging in trenches. There's a variety of risks that we have for our worker safety. Public safety, right? They're at risk as well for a variety of issues. Natural disasters. We know there's going to be another earthquake at some point, but we don't know when it's going to be. So maybe that's that known unknown. And so a lot of those, really all of them, kind of overlap. We know there's going to be a pipe break in the future. What we don't know is where, why, how big, a lot of the details. And then the unknown unknowns, we just don't know what we don't know. But eventually we will know that, and then it'll turn into a known known or a known unknown. Next slide, please. So these next two slides kind of outline a bunch of things that we discussed in the executive staff meeting and several executive staff meetings. And then I'll get into very specific examples as we go forward. So some of the property rights that I mentioned, there's potential litigation. Anytime you own property, there's always potential litigation. There's areas that we don't have easements that we don't know we don't have easements. So those are some of the known unknowns. We just know they're out there and we're finding them. And then I'll also add at the very end, I'll kind of recap and then tell you kind of what we're doing to address some of these risks. There's potential for acquisitions in the future. And anytime you acquire land, there's also potential risks. As I mentioned, the pipeline breaks. Those of you that were here might remember our solar panels up on the hill up here had some wind damage. That was a risk, and we had to pay for that. The imported water supply. There are a ton of risks, and it's not just infrastructure. It could be climate. It could be drought. It could be a number of things, and I'll get into a little bit of detail of that later. In terms of water quality contamination and compliance, there are a lot of known contaminants, right? We issue a consumer confidence report every year that lists a whole host of these contaminants that can be and are in our water supply. Two of the big ones, PFAS and perchlorate, we are addressing. And those are known knowns now. A few years ago, PFAS was a known unknown, right? When the UCMR first came out, the Unregulated Contaminant Monitoring Rule, version 3, we were sampling for PFAS. So we knew there was a contaminant, we just didn't know what the extent was. And then surface water treatment, I guess you can also add groundwater treatment in there now. There's all sorts of potential risks in terms of water quality contamination and compliance. Technology issues. Chris Perez and his team are working diligently to protect us, but there are still issues with cyber attacks. There's various vulnerabilities, widespread outages. And again, I'll get into some of those in more detail. Next slide, please. natural disasters, I just picked the two biggies and then I added the public safety power shutoff, right? We're definitely susceptible to fires and earthquakes. With the winds that are blowing right now, there's a potential for fires to break out. There's a potential for the power shutoff to come. So what do we do? And I'll give the example on this now, just because it's here, is we assess the storage of our distribution system. We raise the level of water in our tanks if we think there's going to be a potential for a fire or a power outage so that we have the supply available in storage in case of those power outages or fires. We also have backup generators. We also have portable booster pumps, things like that. But that's some of the things we do to protect against that. Regulatory violations, I didn't pick all of them. I just picked a few here. NPDES, and I'll get into that later. RMP, CUPA, I'll get into that later. All four of those I'll get into later. Financial and human capital issues. This is something that Rochelle brought to the table. You know, when you talk about risk, it's like an onion. The more you talk about it, the more risks you discover. And there's more things you can put in here. This could have been probably a 3-hour presentation, but don't worry, it's not going to be. Staffing issues, potential loss of revenue, claims. We're always going to be susceptible of claims being filed against our agency for one reason or another. Next slide, please. So these are some of the details now, detailed slides. This is a real easy one. So if you look at the red circle, there's a pipeline that's going between two homes. And there was a leak. We got a call from our customer care. Generally, when a customer says there's water leaking on our property, 99% of the time or even more, it's not our issue. It's generally the homeowner's issue. But we do know that we have pipelines that traverse people's properties. So we went out there. We discovered it. We looked at our maps. We saw that we had a pipeline in here. Fortunately enough, it was a slow leak. And there is a valve on both sides of that pipeline that were able to isolate the leak and kept everybody in water. Nobody was out of service. So then we had to decide, do we fix the leak or not? And we looked at the maps. We looked at our easement records, and we didn't find an easement for this pipe. So we had Christina Jacobs look at that. And sure enough, we didn't have an easement. So now what do we do? Do we try to get an easement from the home property owner, or do we come up with another solution? And so our operations and engineering staff looked at that cul-de-sac at the bottom there with the green circle and saw that those two different, because there's two zones in this area. We saw a way that we can go into the street, connect the two zones, and completely abandon that pipe that goes between the two homes. And that's what we decided to do. So we had the risk. We saw the potential for being vulnerable to that risk, not having an easement, and we came up with a reasonable solution. Next slide. Everybody's familiar with this. Hopefully I don't have to send any more emails out anytime soon. But one of the things that was discussed early on when the agency formed was how does the board know when there's a major pipeline break? And there's a little bit of my discretion in there, but we kind of settled on things that are going to really impact the community, traffic-wise or businesses, because a lot of you might have friends or know people that are in the business community out here. And if it's going to impact, if you get a call, you want to at least be able to speak knowledgeably about that. And you know, if it's a pipeline break in a cul-de-sac, you generally don't get an email on that unless it's one of your good friends that call you. And then I might get a phone call or a text or something that says, hey, Mike, what happened here? But in general, we don't send out emails to the board notifying that unless it's really big. And the other reason is because these pipelines, and you can see on the far right picture, are very expensive to repair in terms of asphalt replacement, right? The actual labor and pipe material to do the leak is not a whole lot. I mean, it's expensive. We're paying overtime. We have full crews and all of that. It's the asphalt restoration that's really expensive. So these are just some images. Our guys down there doing the job. But I just wanted to show this, that this is a potential risk. And again, we don't know when this is going to happen again. We do look at pipe age, material, the type of material. We look at the leak location. We have the master plan. We do hydraulic modeling. I'll get into a little more of that detail later, but these are some of the things that we're doing to try to prevent some of these major pipeline breaks. I think it was Director Atkins years ago before we merged, and he asked me the question, on a scale of 1 to 10, what is the likelihood that a break will occur at some place? I don't know. You can guess, but it can happen tomorrow over here. It can happen next year over there. There are some parameters we look at to help us gauge and guess and predict what's going to happen. And then we act accordingly. We do a pipeline replacement program or something like we're doing in front of Valencia High School and like we've done on Decoro Drive. Next slide, please. Director Bronstein, here's the sewer. So if you can see, we own and operate some sewer. So in the top picture, you see a little red square with a little green tail coming off of it. The red square is our sewer lift station, and it pumps wastewater into that pipeline. Now there's a break. Don't worry, it's not going nowhere. This is just what we own. So we've been giving sewer over to the city when they are interested in taking it. After we do, we have to inspect it. They have to make sure the integrity of the material that we're giving them is okay. And then they'll take ownership of it. Years ago, the former Newhall County Water District looked pretty deeply into getting into the sewer business, and it just wasn't practical. It wasn't cost effective, and it didn't make a lot of sense. So it was better to get out of the sewer business. That upper portion will be something that we'll be giving over to the city as part of Spring Canyon development. They're going to be required to upgrade the pump station and do some other upgrades, and then the city will take that over. The lower portion is still in the river. So there's about 3,000 feet or so that are still in the river. Now, what's the problem with that? Well, when you have major storms, and if you look at the picture in the middle, you can see sort of in the background some corrugated pipe that's above ground. That was an old manhole. And when you have big major storms, El Niño's in 98, 2005, 2006, there's potential for debris to knock that over and then potentially cause a sewer leak or spill into the river, which did happen back then. So what staff had done is in the lower right picture is I don't know if you bulletproofed it, but we really made some improvements to prevent that from happening again. We lowered it. We put a bunch of concrete around it. We GPS the location so that if it gets covered with debris or soil in the future, we know exactly where it is. And then the picture on the left is a picture of the sewer lift station. We do have a backup pump so that if for some reason this facility would fail, we were able to bypass it and then get it out of the city's sewer line and pump it into our pipeline, which then goes into the city's pipeline, which then goes into the county's pipeline, which then goes into the sanitation district's pipeline. That's why it's not good to get into the sewer business in this valley, because there are multiple people handling it. Next slide, please. So the import water supply, Dirk Marks really helped out with this slide. There's a bunch of potential risk, right? Climate change, we don't really know. Is it going to be more like we've seen recently where we're going to have longer periods of drought and then big storms come in and then longer periods of drought? We don't know, but it's a potential. It's a potential risk we need to be aware of, and it's a potential risk that our Water Resource Department is doing what they can to help mitigate some of these risks. Subsidence in the Central Valley, that's a risk. If there's a big earthquake, there was damage to an Edmundston, I think it was a valve last week, Edmundston pumping plant. Those of you not familiar, it's how we get water over the Tehachapis. And what happens if that pumping station goes down and we can't pump water? That's a risk. And just aging infrastructure. The state water project's pretty old, relatively speaking. And the other risk about the state water project is there's multiple stakeholders, right? We can't just go and do things how we think we want to do them. One, it's very expensive, but two, there's multiple stakeholders that you have to negotiate with and discuss things with. Department of Water Resources, Metropolitan Water District, other state contractors, regulatory agencies, local communities, and such. The pictures is the intake tower. And so right now there are 8 tiers for the intake tower at Rio Vista. At Castaic Lake, where it comes into our treatment plants, but only the bottom 3 tiers are submerged. And the bottom 2 tiers are welded shut. So there's only 1 tier where water comes into that intake tower and comes to us and comes to Metropolitan. You might ask, why is it welded shut? We asked the same question. DWR informed us that years ago, there was a couple valves that were broken, and they felt it was better to weld things shut, to keep it shut, than to repair the valves. Primarily because the water level in the lake is generally a lot higher than it has been the last several years. And then I'll talk a little bit more about what caused an issue for us with only having that 1 tier open. Next slide, please. It'll be the one after this. So water quality and compliance examples, right? There's ever-changing drinking water regulations, both state and federal. The federal sets the majority of the guidelines, and the state can come in and make them more stringent. We can't make them less, but the state can make them more. So there's a lot of those known knowns and some known unknowns. The picture on the far right shows Whitaker Burmite property, and it's kind of small to see, but there's various monitoring wells where we help us identify the plume and the way the plume migrates. And then there's the UCMR, the Unregulated Contaminant Monitoring Rule. Every 5 years, the EPA comes up with 30 new contaminants, emerging contaminants that we need to sample for. And I think I've mentioned this in prior meetings. You know, we've sampled for things like TNT, RDX, other explosives. Fortunately, we don't have any of those, but we do have perchlorate. And we have to adapt when we find those discoveries. As the regulators create drinking water regulations, we adapt to that. And as you have been very helpful and instrumental in, I think I saw most of you there the other day, installing groundwater treatment facilities so we can provide safe quality water to our customers. And then there's potential for drinking water violations. The picture on the lower left is Jenny Anderson, our very own water quality specialist. She doesn't always go out there and collect samples, but we thought it was a nice picture to put in there. And there's just issues. There's potential, right? If you have exceedances of things, there's potential for violations. And those violations can vary anywhere from a tier 1, where you have to notify the public within 24 hours, tier 2 within 30 days, or if it's a tier 3, you just have to put it in your consumer confidence report. Next slide. So here's the turbidity issue that was brought to your attention almost about 2 months ago. So in that graph on the left side is what the turbidity coming into our treatment plant looks like. You know, I don't want to say 99.9% of the time, but really is 99.something% of the time, the turbidity is very low. And that's why the plant was designed the way it was designed, with upflow clarifiers as opposed to sedimentation basins. Well, that lower picture, it's kind of hard to tell, was provided by DWR, shows what happened when we had those rains in the middle of September. They caused a mudslide in Elizabeth Creek, and that mud flow came directly into Castaic Lake. Well, in September, those mud flows were cold. The lake was warm, so it went right to the bottom. Well, what's at the bottom? The intake, where we take the water. September, high demands, right? PFAS world, we have a lot of wells that are out of service. So it was a perfect storm for the potential of drinking water violations, turbidity specifically. Fortunately, our staff worked round the clock for weeks. It was at least 2.5 weeks that we experienced this. And you can see how high it shot up. The influent turbidity got as high as 90. And our requirement for sending it out, the CFE, the combined filter effluent, is 0.2. So we had to treat it from 90 down to 0.2. Most drinking water, surface water treatment plants have a limit of 0.3. We're special because we have special technology or advanced technology. I don't know what it is. And they DDW said 0.2. So it is what it is. But fortunately, because of staff's effort and our good relationship with Division of Drinking Water, we avoided the violations because the work that staff did, we did not exceed anything. It was close. We have to have less than 0.2 95% of the time, and it was 94%. So we just made a buy, which was great. Next slide. This is Chris Perez's slide, external threats, phishing, not the type with a pole and fishing line. 61% increase in overall compared to 2021 of what they're seeing coming into our email systems. There's data and operational hack potential. There's third-party breaches. I have no idea what SolarWind is and all of that sort of stuff, but it's third-party breaches potentially. Internal threats, right? People having personal accounts, there's a potential for some hacking that way. Or just human error, right? What was that old commercial where, you know, I hate my job or whatever, and they click on the button and then it says, you know, I don't know, it goes down to everybody. Do you remember that commercial? I don't know. Anyway. But Chris and his team do a tremendous job training us not to click buttons. I don't know, those of you that might have older parents or grandparents and such, I periodically help my in-laws because they sometimes click things that they're not supposed to click because it looks enticing, right? You know, I've made those errors too. And then potential for outages. What if our network goes down? How do we, I mean, we can still do this here. People can still come in, but how do we get work done if there's a complete network shutdown? So those are potential risks. Next slide, please. There's the other regulatory compliance examples, and I said I'd get to these. So NPDES is National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System. And we had a violation right when we first merged because we exceeded sulfate and TDS in some of our discharges from one of our wells. And, you know, there's always that potential. We have to comply with things. But, you know, that it's a lot. Regulations change. I'm not making any excuses, and we do our darndest to prevent that, but it is a risk. Chemical compliance, so that CUPA RMP risk management, we have chlorine gas, and that's the picture in the lower right. It's not our area, but it shows what happens when there's a chlorine gas release. But we work with our local fire department. They do various audits and inspections to help us stay in compliance and staff as well. OSHA compliance, right? If we dig a trench and we don't put the proper shoring, there's a potential for violation. We're just starting to get into the California Air Resource Board and AQMD with our fleet. It's going to be interesting these next 5 to 10, 15 years. What's going to happen? Is there going to be potential for being out of compliance with some of these? You know, I don't know. Again, a known unknown. Next slide, please. So, you know, we got some shady characters working for us in the upper right. Staffing is tough. You know, a bunch of rebels over there. That's our finance. Is it finance or admin or both? Finance. They did. They won, actually, our costume Halloween. Huh? Second place. Oh, who got first? Oh, customer care got first place. Anyway, I thought Kathy Martin actually suggested we put that in. I thought it was cute. But does more conservation equal less revenue? You know, that's a potential. You saw what happened during COVID, right? People weren't paying their bills. Now they were excused for that, but we have to adapt, and that is a risk. What about limited revenue during a catastrophic event? Are we going to be able to process water bills during a major earthquake? Now, granted, there's insurance, there's FEMA funding, there's a lot of ways that we can adapt to that, but it's something we need to be aware of. Loss of legacy staff, loss of legacy knowledge. You know, some of us are going to be retiring in the next 5-10 years, maybe. People are already retiring, right? Mark Passamani, who was our safety, environmental health and safety supervisor, he retired. Ryan Hensley. There's a couple, I think, that are coming next year. So we just have to make sure that we can be attractive enough and hire and maintain that legacy knowledge. Years ago, when I worked for Valencia Water, there was a construction foreman, Eldon Cassie, and he was retiring, and he had been there. He was one of the first, I think, three employees with Valencia Water. And so Bob DiPremio told me he wanted me to start driving with him at least once a week to get his legacy knowledge. And he'd tell me, hey, Mike, 5 feet from that rock over there next to the fence, that's where the pipeline is. Because that's what they did 50 years ago, right? And I put it in here and I remembered, and then we got it surveyed and everything was taken care of. It's a competitive labor market. So we are hiring utility workers, and we had five vacancies, and we had just today one guy backed out that we offered a position to. And was it because it was competitive? Did his prior, you know, I think he was coming from Palmdale, so I don't think they would have offered him more money, but I don't know. It's a competitive market out there. There's always going to be claims. If you see the picture on the right, that was a claim. We had a water break, and a someone in the public drove through, and the front of their truck fell into the sinkhole. And there's a lot of supply chain constraints. With our, I think you remember it was last year. I think it was last year where we received a what do they call it? A force majeure letter from Jones Chemical Company saying, hey, we can't guarantee delivery of chlorine gas. Now, fortunately, we added additional cylinders in there. We had our annual RMP inspection and program update, and we were able to add additional storage. And, you know, fortunately, we didn't have to, you know, fall to a plan B or C on that. Next slide, please. So I'll wrap it up here. What is staff doing? And I kind of interjected some of it. We've hired staff. We have a right-of-way agent that is solely responsible for all of our easements, property rights, all of that sort of stuff, working with Courtney Mail and his group. We do a really good job of tracking new facilities with our inspectors and making sure we do not issue a notice of completion until we have all the proper documentation for easements and property rights. We also hold monthly meetings. Christina has these meetings, and sometimes it's, yep, there's no update, but sometimes one of us legacy folks say, hey, I remember something. Can you check into this area? And then she'll do that and come back and report to the group. As far as infrastructure, we're doing a ton. The master plan is on its way. In fact, we're having facility visits, I think, in December and a little bit in January for condition assessment. There's going to be an updated hydraulic model, proposed capital improvement plan from that. We have a pretty robust pipeline inspection and replacement group. It's cross-departmental with GIS, engineering, and ops, and we also meet monthly. We track all of our leaks so we can identify potential areas that might leak again in the future. We do video survey, TV survey of our sewer trunk line. We do that every 2 years, I think. And we also do wet well at our sewer lift station inspections periodically. Next slide. Water quality, regulatory agency engagement. Ryan Bai and his staff have a great working relationship with Division of Drinking Water, and it just goes a long way. It's really understated, because when we call, they answer, and they're busy, right? We're not their only water utility out there, but they know if we're going to call them, it's for an important reason. We don't bother them with trivial stuff, but they do engage. We have quarterly meetings with them that we discuss projects. We give them a heads up, and we have a project priority spreadsheet that we provide them and update every quarter, so they know what's coming down the pipe. Because they're just dealing with some of the same issues that we are, right? Staffing issues, retirements, all that sort of stuff. We also engage with AWWA, Aqua. We have meetings with Orange County Water District, Burbank Water. We engage with other water agencies to lessons learned, right? There's no sense in reinventing the wheel on something if another agency has already done it or tackled it. Technology, we have a security staff now with our technology group. We have dual authentication, which means if you log into something, you have to have your phone with you so you can press the button. It drives operations folks insane, but it's important, right? We need to make sure who's logging in is who they say they are. It's just another way to prevent potential hacks. And we have all sorts of staff training. One of the new things that our IT group has done is they've been sending out these short little video training. I think they're like 5 minutes or something. And it's great. You know, before you get emails and you just get sort of email overload. But if you get the little quick 5 minute tell you what to do, it goes a long way. For safety, we have a tremendous safety culture. Our staff is really trusting of our safety department. They don't look at our safety department as the safety police. If there's an issue, they bring it up. We have quarterly safety meetings. Monthly safety meetings. Our safety staff goes out to the operations staff every week and conducts tailgates with them. So it really goes a long way, and it helps us have a better safety culture and be safer in the field. We also have inspections. We do audits. We hire outside consultants. Director Gutzeit, when we first merged, we did the one with Tetra Tech, which was very valuable. We have a lot of policies and procedures. We have JPIA audits. In fact, tomorrow JPIA is coming out and doing some facility inspections with us and our safety group. There's compliance standards, audits. I think that's the last slide, April. One more. Are there more unknown unknowns? Absolutely. And I'd be happy to answer anybody's question. Don't know that I'll have an answer.
Thank you, Mike, for your presentation. Madam Secretary, do we have any public comment on Mr. Alford's presentation?
We do not.
Very good.
Before I make my comment, Director Bronstein, was that sufficient presentation on risk assessment?
You want my honest opinion?
Honest.
I mean, I could have gone a little bit deeper personally, but I mean, that could be a one-on-one too.
Would you like to see a risk assessment matrix for a particular project or hot work permits, things of that nature?
I mean, it was a great presentation, but it seemed like it was more philosophical than actual.
I do study stoicism.
I mean, the first quote was on point.
Okay. Thank you, Director Bronstein. So who decided to use Donald Rumsfeld's infamous quote? Okay.
Sorry.
No, you know, one of those things is you have those personal heroes like Lech Walesa, Robert McNamara, or Donald Rumsfeld. And then you read their memoirs, and then you read them with a cringe, pretty much, and because you find out what their thinking was. I believe the known unknowns and unknown unknowns, which was a memo that he sent to his team at the Pentagon, was an excuse. And known unknowns and unknowns unknowns. God, I hated that memo. I think it's a 20-something, 30-something mentality. If you're a civil engineer, mechanical engineer, you make mistakes, but you learn through them. And Mr. Rumsfeld was a very seasoned individual. And to use that, which I understand why you're using it in this presentation, was not particularly fair to the American public. So I feel the same way here. I think we have some very seasoned and well-educated and well-informed senior leadership at SCV Water. You guys take a very preemptive approach on issues, whether it's supply chain, I was experienced with chlorine and with PFAS media. And you're doing all your best to make sure that our ratepayers do get, reliable and good quality water. And, if that excuse, well, if that comment is ever made in the future that, was an unknown unknown, I don't believe in that. I think all of you are, as I said before, well-seasoned and well-educated, and you do take creative actions, and we want, at least and I believe the whole board shares the same sentiment, would like for you guys to continue take those preemptive actions. So, you know, you're not 20 years old anymore, Mr. Alvord.
I'm not?
No. So that's where I stand. As far as risk assessment, you know, thank you for this holistic big picture item. It definitely shows that you guys are taking a preemptive approach on all these different fronts. I personally do not need to see a risk mitigation matrix or how you assess different projects. I think that's maybe between you and Director Bronstein if she wants to see those details. Mm-hmm. But again, I would like to emphasize that one of the benefits of this agency is you know, the senior leadership, and we really hold you in high regard. At least I do, and I think most of the board members here. And we want you to continue doing that work, that preemptive approach, and you know, it's for the benefit of our ratepayers and our families. We all live here. That's my comment. Back to you, President Martin.
Well, thank you, and I'll make sure I run quotes by you ahead of time for future presentations.
Director Cooper, go ahead.
Thank you, President Martin, and thank you, Mike. That was excellent. I really enjoyed that tonight. I think this, and I'm sorry, Peter, but I like the quote. I didn't like Rumsfeld, but I like the quote. And I think PFAS is one of those examples of known unknowns. And there are thousands of them out there. We don't know the effect of them, but we know they're coming about. And there is a risk that's associated with those that we're going to have to face at some time. And what I think this was a great exercise, probably for you as well as for us, to understand is how many risks you have out there. And I'm sure this exercise in putting these things down brought things to light for the water agency of here's things that we need to continue looking at and prioritizing some of these. I like the 30,000 foot level. I don't know that we need to get down into the details of that. That's your job. But I like the idea of knowing that you're looking at them, at least from our level, and putting the plans together for those. So I think this was a great exercise, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Director Cooper. Director Gutzeit.
I also really liked the presentation. One thought, I feel like we can't overemphasize what I call political impacts, but regulatory impacts. And some of that is the unknowns that, you know, what's going to be the next issue. So I hope that we continue to stay involved, not only in the water world, but also in other regulatory groups, or, you know, participate, the right people participate in those programs. For instance, CARB is talking a lot about the electrification mandates. They have some pretty harsh electrification mandates that I don't think are going to fly. I mean, heavy equipment mandates. But, you know, we need to be in that group, whoever's talking about that and participating on whether it's practical or not, rather than have it affect us and we didn't see it coming. Because, yeah, we'll have to sell off equipment and buy compliant equipment if it gets to that point. And then also, sorry, I get very geeked out about when you mention compliance. There's a CUPA conference. It's the best conference in the world. And it's in Anaheim in March. And it's a great deal. And they have the inspectors for the ammonia, the chlorine, all that stuff, all the potential things we could get written up for and things that, you know, could blow up and all the other fun videos. They have that conference. So maybe somebody wants to go to the CUPA conference. And then lastly, I'm going to share my favorite quote, which came from an advertisement. Take the risk. What's the best thing that can happen? Not the worst thing, but what's the best thing that can happen? So that's it.
Director Bronstein.
So thank you so much for this presentation. I actually really appreciate it. And I actually agreed with I think that the quote that you started with was very zen in a way. And I guess It's a very holistic approach. And I totally get it. There's things that we don't even know, like aliens, right? Like there's things that completely we can't even like think about, right?
Is the world round?
Exactly. Hopefully we know the answer to that one. I really do hope so. That was great. I think I personally was looking for a little bit less philosophical and knowing about like literally do we have more sewage pipes in rivers, like things
what
like
you saw there is the only one we have.
But and things like that. So that was my that's what I was curious about. However, you did make me curious about Castaic Lake and the one opening that we have. On what level is it? Like, are we at risk to not be able to then pump through it if it gets like lower, or is it on the bottom floor?
Yeah, if it did get lower, yeah, we wouldn't be able to take water out of the lake. Fortunately, they don't let it go below that. Metropolitan is the big player in Castaic Lake, and they rely on this water supply a lot. So while we are a small part of it, they're a bigger part. And we do attend the, I don't even know what it stands for, OME, the operation. It's the state water contractor, operations, maintenance, and engineering. Thank you. Committee wow. meeting, of course. of course. And, We're constantly working with them and understanding, but yeah, that was, we're pushing now for them to give us a really good explanation and what would it take to repair the lower two tiers. So I think we're getting close to being above the fourth tier. So something I just learned recently is every year they're required to take water. I think it's 10% or whatever out of Pyramid and put it in Castaic. So they're doing that now. I think it's supposed to be done by, it's either December 2nd or the 10th. And based on that volume of water, we will be above the fourth tier. So we'll have two tiers to choose from. My heavy metal roots, sorry. But it is a risk.
Okay. Thank you. I mean, that was just a question that I had because yep. you piqued my curiosity there.
Oh, there is? Okay.
Time to take notes.
I am. Chris Perez style. No more paper.
President Martin, there is one of our employees on the line who had his hand up. I'm not sure if he still wanted to speak. Did you
he just sent me a text. He said, sorry, hit on accident.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I immediately text him because if it was something urgent.
All right. Director Armitage.
Thank you. So I'll add my thanks to you too. I always appreciate your very engaging presentations, although I'm a little disappointed you didn't start us off with a meditation this time.
I thought about it.
Yes. I appreciated the kind of the 30,000 foot view. I think that's a good starting point for the board. And, you know, if there's a desire to dig deeper, we can always do that either on a one-on-one or in a committee. And what I'm always looking for during these types of presentations is reassurance that the agency is doing everything it possibly can to plan for, you know, when things go wrong, because we know they are going to go wrong at some point, and mitigating the effects to the public's health and to property and to infrastructure. So, I appreciate hearing this information, and it does give me reassurance that there's a lot of thought being put to that. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
Any other comments or questions from the board?
I'll just say that I really appreciated it too. And one of the things that I appreciated is knowing these things like chlorine shortage and the silt in the lake, and they get solved. I mean, it's so amazing to me. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike. I think it's a good exercise for staff. I think it's certainly useful information for the board, and we appreciate it. So With that, we can move on to item 8, General Manager's Report on Activities, Projects, and Programs. Mr. Stone.
Okay, thank you. I'll try to. I'm looking for a different metaphor than the Rumsfeld quote, because it bothers me too, but I think it's a great quote. That's the problem, you know. People are complex. They do good things and they do stuff that you don't like. So Teddy Roosevelt was good for that too, right? He had some fantastic quotes and some really great things. And I read all the McCullough biographies I could get my hand on, and you learn that people, historical figures, are extremely complicated people, just like the rest of us. Moving on from the philosophical, just an update on a number of activities and meetings. As part of the October State Water Contractors meeting, which normally has been meeting in Sacramento, but historically had met in different locations in the state in order to facilitate some more regional awareness and communication among the contractors. At the suggestion of one of our longtime board members, we did that. We met in Santanilla along the I-5 there and in the Central Valley. And we took that opportunity, it's very close to San Luis Reservoir, to visit the San Luis Field Division, DWR, on a little field trip. We saw work that's beginning to take place on Sisk Dam, which is the dam that forms San Luis Reservoir, to do further seismic improvements there. It seems like they've done a number of those over the life of that dam. We took a tour of the William R. Gianelli Pumping and Generating Plant, which is the huge pump station that pushes water up into San Luis off of the canal, and generally in the winter and spring months when it's abundant. It then sits up in San Luis Reservoir, and at some point during the year when it's taken out, it goes back downhill and goes through generators. The pumps do serve double duty so that the energy is recovered in that process. It was a very impressive plant. I wasn't allowed to take any pictures inside, though, so no photos to share. But if you've seen one giant pumping station, you've seen them all. But they're still pretty amazing. We also visited the San Luis National Wildlife Refuge Visitor Center, which was very impressive. If you ever have a chance to visit that on your way up the valley, it's a little bit off the beaten path, but once you find it, it's a really impressive little visitor center, lots of good taxidermy and birdidermy and educational exhibits, really neat educational exhibits in that thing. And a very abundant representation of live insects outside if you're there around dusk, which we were. We then took a sunset drive over to and through the Merced National Wildlife Refuge, which is an enormous facility. And then on to a dinner hosted at the warehouse on folding tables of the Grassland Water District, which is a Central Valley contractor. And they pretty much serve water to wildlife refuges, some farms, and other habitat areas. So they're very focused on that as a core piece. And I'll get into that a little more. I've got some more comments coming up on that. So it was a good opportunity to see the main pumping and generating facilities, one of the main facilities serving both the CVP and the state project. That's a shared facility there at San Luis Reservoir. We have about half of the capacity of the reservoir, and the Central Valley Project has the other half. And when you hear at the Water Resources Committee, San Luis carryover, that's where the San Luis carryover water lives. And when we need it in a dry year, we pull it out of there. So the wildlife refuges were just incredibly impressive to me, just the scale of driving through them for some time, and we're still in the wildlife refuge as we go. Hundreds of thousands of birds may be there at any given time. There's several million that fly on that Pacific Flyway every year. It's pretty impressive. And in fact, this Thanksgiving time is coming up and the sandhill cranes are moving in. So that's another great tip for wildlife viewing, is if you go up in the winter months, you can see just tens of thousands of sandhill cranes in that facility, in that refuge. Let's see, moving on, more locally, I had a huge thank you to our staff team who planned and designed and oversaw construction of the Valley Center well PFAS treatment facility. We had a great opportunity and great weather Wednesday morning last week to celebrate that milestone, another step in efforts to restore wells to service with appropriate treatment installed, and was appreciative that we were able to have that ribbon cutting and not have to do it virtually as we did with the first one. The team that worked on the actual event did a great job. I really thought the signage and the setup and, you know, having a dual live stream with Facebook while we were doing the event in person was pretty darn good. And yet it was kind of like nice minimalist, you know, we had coffee, but we didn't have like giant pastries or anything like that. So that was small cost savings there. So Kathy and your team, thanks very much for that. Kathy Martin and all the support staff who made that happen. And of course the work continues in constructing it at Santa Clara Hanvey site, and we're continuing to work on design and planning of additional treatment facilities that will return more groundwater to service. Moving on to another activity, last Thursday we held our first stakeholder meeting on the development of the retail capacity fee for the Valencia division. We've talked a little bit about that in finance committee previously, so that work is proceeding with our consultant and our staff team of finance and engineering supporting that. It was, I thought, a good meeting. The first meeting was just to talk about the background of why we're doing the study and what the basic procedural aspects of it are in terms of the law, and then what the approach that our consultant is proposing to take in developing that fee. And we took Q&A about those aspects of it from members of the stakeholder group, which in this case were mostly people who are paying the fee. But there is also built into that process, there will be a review from the ratepayer advocate to look at the proposal. And you can anticipate that this item will be coming back to the Finance and Administration Committee early next year. Currently, we're thinking February, with then hopefully moving that onto the board for consideration after that. Let's see, earlier this year, the board approved going forward with soliciting bids for two projects which were eligible for the SGIP incentive funds that are offered through the California Public Utilities Commission. That was for battery installations, you may recall. We worked with a consultant, Terra Verde, to kind of start with a page of possible projects and screen that down based on which ones had the best return on our money and the best overall leveraging of SGIP credits that were available. We then, after getting approval from the board to move forward, we narrowed that down to basically two projects that we would move forward. One at Earl Schmidt that had solar and battery, and one at Rio Vista that adds battery to our existing solar facility. And unfortunately, our bidding experience was not good. We put the projects out to bid. We got no bidders. That was obviously concerning. We conferred with prospective bidders. We conferred with Terra Verde. And the general sense is this is a moment where the supply chain uncertainty for this size project, along with some of the complexity at trying to site solar at Schmidt, had kind of discouraged bidders. And the advice of Terra Verde was to go forward and see if we can negotiate battery vendor contracts and or bid them. So we've talked to legal counsel about that. There is probably a pathway where we could do sole source. I'm not totally comfortable with that, but we also have a time clock running in order to take advantage of the SGIP funding. So I think our current thought is we will bring something back to the board, either bids in hand or a negotiated contract, which the board can then vote up or down so that it's not sole source without the board weighing in on it. The net effect of this in terms of money is we will actually be spending less money because the solar portion of the Schmidt project was going to be self-funded. There was no grant money going towards that. And so if we just bid batteries at those locations, we will still get the same amount of SGIP funding, but our capital outlay will be cut by about two-thirds overall. And I mean, a little vague on that because we won't know till we actually see what kind of pricing we can get. And if the pricing isn't good, we may decide that we just don't want to go forward at this point. So wanted to, that's kind of a, you know, full disclosure moment there to let you know a project you previously approved is encountering a little bit of headwind, and we're going to try to see what we can do to deliver a project that would be still economically beneficial and operationally beneficial to the agency at this point in time. So that we don't finish on a complete downer, staff will be bringing back two things to the Finance Administration Committee next week. One is an effort that I know we have wanted to bring forward, but has been sort of in the pandemic stall mode because of just the logistics of people and proximity. But we are bringing a post internship program for review and comment. And I think we're all pretty excited about that. I think there's a lot of potential upside on that one. So the committee will get a shot at providing some comment on that before we, if they're satisfied with it or with their input, we will bring that forward to the board. And then the other is a revised flexible workplace policy, and that was pursuant to input we already received, that the board, after the 1 year review, was comfortable with increasing the number of work from home days. So we have a proposal on that and the accompanying changes in policy that would support that, as well as a couple minor other tweaks to the policy from a year of working with it. And then finally, I'll just say, and this is on a future agenda, but I'll just mention, I do appreciate, and I did have an opportunity while I was kind of stuck in COVID land in Chicago to receive an overview and walkthrough of the board's performance evaluation with Mitch and a delegation from the board leadership. And I just want to express my thanks to the board for their very detailed and constructive comments in that. And that's, as I said, on a future agenda, but just didn't want to let it go unnoticed. And that's it for tonight.
Turn this on. Madam Secretary, do we have any public comment on Mr. Stone's report?
We do not.
Very good. We have any questions or discussion? Director Armitage, go ahead.
Thank you. Just one question. You'd mentioned the stakeholder meeting for the Valencia retail fees, and you said most of the people were the customers who would be paying the fees. Who else was part of that stakeholder group?
So I think we had representation from EDC. Holly, I think, or one of her staff was there. So they don't directly pay fees, but obviously they're interested in the business impacts in the community. And then we had a number of builders in the valley. Primarily, that was the bulk of the participants. I think there was about eight or nine people there, as I recall. But we take notes on it, so that'll be documented.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Director Colley.
Yeah, on that, I note that whenever we do a wholesale increase in the connection fees, we always end up with this surge of folks right before the new fee comes into or the new higher fee. Is there a way we can avoid folks creating that surge when they're going from free to something? Is there Have we thought about a way to try to avoid that, or do we not anticipate that being a problem?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard to mitigate that because you have to legally adopt the fee. I don't think you can make it retroactive. So the best mitigation is to move quickly. But we also want to balance that with not being, you know, accused of doing it in the dark or not letting people know it was coming. So,
right. I'm just wondering, is there any way that we can simply say, you know, we're just not accepting applications until this, you know, something along those lines. I don't know if we could run something by the lawyers to try to figure out if that there is a way to do it relatively inexpensively and easily.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I will take the comment under advice so that we're not going too far out on the Brown Act, but I won't seek board direction yet on that, but I hear the comment.
Yeah. All right. Any other questions or comments from the board? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Stone, for your report. We can move on to item 9, committee meeting recap reports for informational purposes only. There was one report that was included in the packet and one that was emailed to us and posted to the website yesterday as well as at each of our spots. First of all, do we have any public comment on the committee reports?
We do not.
Very good. Do we have any director questions for the staff on the committee reports? Seeing none, we can move on to item 10, President's Report. Do a brief update on various meetings that are coming up. First of all, under the category of outside the agency conference and events, the AQUA 2022 Fall Conference is being held in Indian Wells from November 29th through December 1st. For those attending AQUA on November 29th from 1 to 2 p.m., hear the latest about the proposed Delta conveyance project. There will be another presentation, much like there was in the spring conference. And it'll be done during the conference on Tuesday from 1 to 2. State Water Contractors and the Delta Conveyance Design and Construction Authority are co-hosting and would like to share the project's latest developments. We want to ensure that all participating agencies are on the same page about the project as we approach the end of the draft EIR public comment period. It will be the briefing on the status of the Delta Conveyance Project Tuesday, November 29th from 1 to 2 p.m. at the Fall Conference in the Monte Carlo Room. RSVPs are needed to attend. Please send your RSVP to April by 2:30 p.m. on Wednesday, November 23rd. A brief friendly reminder that we need to ensure that we are compliant with the Brown Act and do not run into quorum issues. We have 5 spots left. The first 5 directors to respond will be added to the list. And I might add, if any of us are planning to attend and already have seen the presentation at the spring AQUA, I would suggest perhaps we give others a chance if we run into a quorum issue only. But please, if you're interested, let April know.
Mr. Chairman?
Okay, other upcoming events, we will have an agency holiday party on December 15th from 11:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. Oh, go ahead, Mr. Bell.
I'm sorry, but because that's a meeting that is open to the membership of AQUA and open to the, well, it's not completely open to the public, nevertheless, I believe a quorum of the board can attend that, and as long as they don't participate in the discussion other than with the panelists.
Okay. April, you have any response to Mr. Bunn's comment?
Mr. Byrne, yeah, I talked to, or Mr. Bunn, I talked to Mr. Byrne today, and Mr. Byrne said he did not, that he felt that there would be a quorum issue and that we could, because we are involved with the Delta conveyance and we will be voting on that at some point, he didn't think that we should have more than a quorum of the board. It's separate.
Yeah, it's not really part of the conference program, and I think that was the issue.
It is not.
Making it convenient for people who are going to be in town by having a briefing off-site. So that was the concern that it's
a gray area. If it's not open to the public, then that's right. I withdraw my comment.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Bowen. All right, we're back to the announcements. The agency holiday party on December 15th from 11:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. will be at the center, City of Santa Clarita Activity Center. More information will be forthcoming. Upcoming board meetings start time at 6 p.m. The regular board meeting for December 6th and the regular board meeting for December 20th, both in this boardroom. Upcoming committee meetings for the month of November and December held at Summit Circle and the ESS boardroom at 5:30 p.m., the November 17th Public Outreach and Legislation Committee, the December 8th Engineering and Operations Committee, the December 14th Water Resources and Watershed Committee, the December 15th Public Outreach and Legislation Committee. Upcoming committee meetings for the month of November and December held at Real Vista will be the November 21 Finance and Administration Committee meeting and the December 12 rescheduled Finance and Administration Committee meeting. Other announcements: at each of your spots is a manila envelope with updates to your policies and procedures binder. Please make sure that you update your binder with the attachments in your envelope. All right, I think we'll forego the next one. And that concludes the president's report. I will, though, mention for directors who may be leaving the board, we will have at future board meetings, some will actually run into January, we'll have recognition for directors who are leaving the board. So that will be taken care of. And that concludes my report. Any public comment, April?
There is not.
Very good. Any questions from the board? Seeing none, we can safely move on to item 11, AB 1234 reports. There was one AB 1234 report included in your packet and two that were posted to the website and emailed out. Does anyone have an additional AB 1234 report? Wow. Director Kelly.
Every year, the Chamber of Commerce sponsors the Patriot Luncheon. I was happy to attend on behalf of the agency. They awarded recognition to six local veterans who have done things in our community. And I think it's something that they're looking to continue for quite some time. There was a conversation about how many of these veterans couldn't have survived over these 40 and 50 years without spouse's involvement and support and everything like that. And so I have made a recommendation to the chamber that they should recognize one spouse at the next event, and we'll see if that actually happens. So, but with that, I want to thank the agency for allowing me to attend. Just a footnote aside from that, since we're talking about veterans, I attended a program put on by veterans to where we packaged 10,368 meals. We had nine veteran organizations there to distribute the meals, and all the meals went to our local community for veterans. So once again, has nothing to do with the agency as far as reporting out, but I just like to thank the agency for continued involvement in supporting our veterans. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Kelly, for representing the agency at that event. Any other? Oh, Director Ozahowski.
All right. On the 4th of November, I attended the Via Bash. No specific report from there. On November 9th, I've also attended the SCV Chamber of Commerce 12th Annual Salute to Patriots. Certainly appreciate Director Kelly being there. And on another note, on Friday, Director Kelly also attended a salute to patriots hosted by the City of Santa Clarita, and where the City of Santa Clarita was providing dog tags to veterans in memory of the Vietnam War, where the dog tag stated, welcome home, welcome back home. I thought that was very moving. And Director Kelly, thank you for being there and for passing out those dog tags.
Thank you very much for bringing that up. And part of the dog tags recognizes the Vietnam era, not just boots on the ground. They also changed out to what they referred to as blue water, people that were on the ships. And I did bring a dog tag for Director Cooper. I'd like to give it to you afterwards.
Okay. Thank you, Director Kelly, Director Cooper, and Director Colley for your service. On November 5th, I did attend the tour of Valencia Water Reclamation Plant with Director Ford and Director Colley and Director Planback. Very good presentation by one of their engineers. On one specific note, their UV system, one issue that they're having is the UV intensity is being blocked by all the crud going through the sleeves. So they're trying to experiment by using different types of acids to clean them or to replace them. So I'm looking forward to new ways to mitigate and adapt to that issue that almost every water treatment has, but whether it's on the ship or on shoreside. And I believe that's it. That's it for me. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Ozahowski. Any other AB 1234 reports? Nothing on this side. Director Ford.
Thank you, President Martin. As the Vice President mentioned, I did also attend the Sanitation District tour of the wastewater treatment plant. It was well done between their plant staff and their outreach staff. And I was there a little early and picked up all the materials that their outreach had put out. So I thought I'd forward these to Kathy Martin. And also found out that they have an educational program where they take students, middle and high schoolers, and teach them the ins and outs, if you will, of wastewater treatment. And I thought that they have a very enthusiastic person who is in charge of the program, whose card I have here, that would be a golden opportunity for students in the Valley to go first with us and learn about how to treat potable water and then what happens to it after it goes on down to the wastewater treatment plant as well, too. And they have, transportation services and everything else. It seemed like it just parallels our program. And so I thought there may be some benefits to the staffs on both parties talking to each other. So I will give this material on to Kathy, and the staff can hopefully talk to their equals at the sanitation district.
Thank you, Jeff. Director Bronstein.
On November 9th, I got to attend two things. I got to go attend to the ribbon cutting for our water treatment facility, which was really great to see. And it was great. It was just awesome. And then two, I got to attend the Chamber of Commerce Salute to Patriots. I was there. It was great. It was great. One of my friends was honored. So it was very meaningful, and thank you all for your service.
Thank you, Director Bronstein. Any other AB 1234 reports? Director Cowley.
Yeah, I did also attend the Sand District tour. Thank you.
Thank you. Nothing anymore. Any public comment, April, on the AB 1234 reports?
There is not.
Very good. Thank you, directors. We can move on to item 12, director requests for future agenda items. Are there any requests for future agenda items? Seeing none, there's no public comment to be had on no reports. That moves us to item 13, adjournment. And I want to thank staff for their work tonight. Thank the board for your work tonight. And we are hereby adjourned. Good night and good evening. Thank you.